Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. By the way, we are streaming live on biz1190.com, and you can catch a podcast of today's program on eddiemayfield.com. So check us out there. Here at Driven to Business, we like to talk about business, entrepreneurship, leadership, and everything in between, marketing, sales, you name it. We like to talk about it. We have a great guest today. Our guest today is Steve Damoreaux. Steve is the Chief Executive Officer of Loyalty Works, which is a business-to-business marketing incentive company. Steve, welcome to Driven to Business.
Thank you very much, Eddie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, it's glad to have you here. You're an interesting guy in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm very successful in business and a good business person in general. But one thing I find a bit interesting is how your family got to the United States. It's a bit of an unusual story. Tell us about that.
Well, my father was in the Wehrmacht. He was in the German Wehrmacht. He was drafted when he was 17. He was on the Russian front. He was in the Africa Corps.
Wow.
And he was finally, after 5 years, after he'd been shot three times before, was captured in the Battle of Monte Cassino in 1944. A lot of people don't know this, but the German prisoners in the World War II were all shipped back to the United States. So he actually was in a concentration camp here in the United States. And what is now the Phoenix Zoo used to be a concentration camp.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. So for him, it was probably after 5 years of war, it was almost like a vacation. They got leave. They got paid 50 cents a day. They picked cotton. They picked apples. And he actually goes back on a regular basis to go back and visit some of the places that he worked at.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, I have an uncle who recently passed away that served in Europe in World War II. And right at the end of the war, he was transferred back to the United States, but was still in the Army. And my grandmother, years and years ago, showed me a letter that my uncle had written her. And he was working with some German prisoners of war. And what he said in there was, you know, it's interesting. They look just like us.
Yeah.
Because I think in war, we all sort of do characterizations of our enemy in order to make them look more inhuman in some way, so we can go to be at war with them. But I think that was something that a lot of Americans did learn. Of course, I grew up in Alabama, and the space program there in Huntsville, the primary guy in charge there was a guy named Werner von Braun, who was a German scientist, later captured by the Russians, I think, and then somehow the United States ended up with him. I think this is where that happened.
Well, all things being equal, they all would rather be captured by the United States than by the Russians.
I can believe that for sure. You know, Steve, I grew up in Birmingham, as I said, and in Birmingham we had a large immigrant population. I went to high school with a lot of families who were either first generation or second generation immigrants to the United States from all over Europe. They'd come here after the war, and they came here to this part of the country because of the steel mills and the mines around Birmingham, and a lot of them worked there. And then and then all the service industries that popped up around those mines and steel mills over there, and some of them were very successful in business and became later quite successful. One I know my dad had told me about, and I know the name of the store, was started off basically selling vegetables and knickknacks off of a horse-drawn wagon in these mining camps, and later became a national, which grew into a fixed brick-and-mortar store, and then grew into a national department store chain, which he later sold to Macy's, actually. So it's a great success story. And I grew up hearing stories my granddad would tell me about, that some of these guys that came here, they came here with nothing. And he used to always laugh about that. They had nowhere down. There was no down to go to. So their attitude was there's only up. And that attitude really drove them into business. I'm just curious with your background and the way your family had come here. Did that influence your drive toward business as a young man?
Well, after the war was over, actually all the prisoners were sent back to Germany.
Okay.
They didn't have a choice. And they had to apply for a visa to get back to the United States.
Right.
In my father's particular case, he couldn't go back to where he was because of the Russians. He met my mother in Stuttgart. She was a refugee from Czechoslovakia. But it took them 10 years to get back to the United States.
Wow.
And it was only after they were sponsored by a Methodist church in Demarest, Georgia, that took responsibility for them. They took the physical, the financial responsibility. It wasn't a government issue. It was an association, an organization, a church, a group. And I was actually named after a man that was responsible for bringing my parents over.
Wow.
So what impressed my father when he was a prisoner of war here in the United States was the humanity of the people. And he wanted to get back because he felt that, the Americans always had a little bit on the ball, but they were good, honest, hardworking people. And that was always instilled in me. And I think that you'll notice that immigrants are usually extremely patriotic towards the United States because they know it's not as good somewhere else.
I think all of us perhaps at times, Steve, do get a little bit we start taking things for granted. And I think you can put that in any level of life. We take things for granted with our families. We take things for granted with our friends. We certainly, I know both of us in business know it's a huge mistake to ever take your customers for granted, which is part of what you do, is to be sure that's not happening. But that's an interesting take on the fact that when you're outside the United States looking in what we have here, that it seems more valuable to you than it does perhaps if you grow up in it and you don't really recognize the value of it so much.
Well, at 18, a lot of Americans don't realize this also, but you can have a dual citizenship in the United States. It's a lot of people don't understand it, but the Supreme Court recognized in 1988, I had a choice to be a German or an American citizen when I was 18. And I definitely chose the United States because I could not stand the bureaucratic, controlled way of life there in Germany, especially when it came to do with academics and then with business. And so I'm very happy to be in business in the United States. And I think that you'll find statistically that businesses in the United States is still one of the most competitive places in the world to start a business.
No, I had a dual citizenship, Alabama and Georgia, and when my kids started going to school, you know, being from Alabama, and you're a Roll Tide guy, but then you come over here and you go to Georgia. I was torn between that, you know, but I finally decided I've spent more money here in Georgia than was ever spent in Alabama, so that made my decision there. You know, Steve, you're very entrepreneurial. At what point in your life, when did you decide you were going to be in business, to have your own business?
Well, when I got out of grad school, it was 1979. The economy was bad. It was after the Vietnam War. It was almost as bad as it is now. And there was a lot of layoffs. And I felt that the layoffs were very impersonal. And I decided that if I was going to get fired, I wanted somebody to look me in the face and tell me why.
Right.
And so that's why I decided early on that I did not want to work for a big company.
You'll appreciate it. I think the worst firing example I ever saw, when I got out of the Coast Guard, I went to work for a television station over in Alabama. And it was sort of shift work. I was a technician there going to school at the time. And we worked shift work. And every week, and it varied depending on production schedules and this, that, and the other. And so every week, like when you would come in and start your week, you went and looked at a board, and your schedule was on the board, and you'd look at it. Well, I don't remember how many of us guys there were. There were 8 or 10 of us there in my department. And we came in one week, and one of the guys' names wasn't on there. So he went in to ask his boss and said, "Hey, I see I'm not on the schedule." "Yeah," I said, "it's because you don't work here anymore."
Well, yeah.
That is the worst way of firing I've ever. In fact, after I got to know the boss later, I told him, "So you're not going to fire me like that. I won't take it. So you're going to have to call me in and tell me you're firing me." You know, you mentioned graduate school. I know you went to Berry College here in Georgia. Tell us about your rest of your education.
Well, first of all, anybody in the listening voice of this radio station has to understand how beautiful Berry College is.
Yeah, it is gorgeous.
55,000 acres.
Yes.
I think theoretically the largest campus in the world.
Yeah.
It's right up there in Rome, Georgia. It's just a charming, charming place. But it also was very restricted in the sense that it wasn't really worldly back then. And so I ended up got a scholarship and I went to graduate school in University of Freiburg in Germany International economics. They actually paid me to go to school.
Are you bilingual? Do you speak German?
I do. Yes.
Okay.
And then after that, and once again, this was in the 70s, and the United States needed to emerge out of being a provincial power and becoming an exporter. Still hasn't happened, actually, but nevertheless, right. there was a lot of talk about it.
Right.
And so I ended up going to a graduate school called the American Graduate School of International Management, Thunderbird, which is consistently rated as top 10 business schools in the United States and top international school in the world.
I was not aware, you told me just now, I have seen your bio, but I didn't know, I'm just not paying close enough attention. I didn't see that you had actually gone to work, you actually gone to school back in Germany. That's kind of, I always thought that would be fun. I never did that. I always thought it'd be fun to do it. I've been to Germany a number of times, and I do enjoy going over there. What was, just as far as the college experience, there and here, is it, what you got any...
Well, first of all, they have socialized medicine. They have socialized education.
Right.
Well, it works the same way. It's extremely impersonal. You're sitting there in a class with 600 students.
Really?
It takes you all year to get in I remember I had a appointment with my professor and was on the elevator going down one day. I mean, that was as close as I ever got to the professor. He didn't know who I was, didn't know my name, no nothing.
I think from Berry College, that would be quite a change.
It was quite a change because Berry College is very intimate, very small, very hands-on. It was an awakening for me.
Well, it still sounds like it would be fun. I think I would enjoy doing that. You know, I went to the University of Alabama in Birmingham, which was and is a large school. Although we're not the Roll Tide guys, Bear Bryant never went there or anything. But it was a large school. But I was in nowhere near a class of 600 people. I mean that was, and I could talk to my professors anytime pretty much that I wanted to, without any issues at all. Stephen, in a few minutes, I want to talk to you about Loyalty Works, how you started that, and what it is exactly you guys do. I think it'll be a lot of interest to folks listening. I think it's always interesting to hear someone that actually started an idea, started a business, and made it successful. I think that's what we like to talk about here on Driven to Business, and I think all of us enjoy and can learn from that. You are listening to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday, 11 o'clock, right here on WAFS Biz 1190. And hang around. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We are glad you're here. Our guest today is Steve Damrow. Steve is the Chief Executive Officer of Loyalty Works. Back in 1993, Steve started a company called Incentive Solutions, and then in 2009, he actually purchased Loyalty Works. Steve, tell us how, or I guess, what does Loyalty Works do, and is it similar to what you did in Incentive Solutions? Is it a growth of that? Is it a similar thing?
It's a growth of that, and it's kind of a story of a winnow swallowing the whale. I started Incentive Solutions in 1993, and we did sales incentive programs, and back then, we basically were more than glorified travel agents. Basically, people back then did President's Clubs, and they took their top people to Hawaii. That's since become a political pariah where they're laying people off, and it was said that was extravagant. So a lot of people are migrating towards what we call online rewards malls and online rewards platforms. So Incentive Solutions, I recognized when I started it that we needed to change as an industry and become more technologically advanced. And we needed to change the rewards that we were going after. I think everybody remembers the gold stamps, the green stamps. You know, I saved all year long, and
I've licked many a green stamp, but those things in the books. Yep.
So, and you look at the books, and there's 1,100 items in the books, and all you can afford is a lime green toaster, and it takes 6 weeks to get
it. Exactly.
All right.
Yep.
So, I just couldn't embrace that. So we actually were one of the first companies ever to start a promotion using prepaid debit cards. So what we think is commonplace now in terms of debit cards, promotions, do this, get $50 rebate, that type of stuff, we were actually one of the first ones that ever did that in 1993. We also were one of the first companies as incentive solutions to create an online rewards marketing platform and rewards mall. And then, so to answer your question about LoyaltyWorks, LoyaltyWorks had been in business much longer than we had. A VC firm in Boston actually bought them and invested a lot of money in them because they had a good reputation, they had a lot of clients, but they had bad technology. Well, they never got their technology to work. They were losing money, and basically I was able to mate our superior technology with, very candidly, their superior customer service, and they had some very good employees. So I took their employees on, mated it with our technology, and we turned the company around in the first 3 months, and we've been making profit ever since.
You know, I'm listening to that. That mirrors, in some ways, in a smaller scale, when we purchased another company some years ago, and they were losing money at the time we got them, and their problem, honestly, was they were not. Well, it was a management issue, but they mainly were just not doing any selling to speak of, and they had had customer attrition and had done nothing about it, but they had a great reputation. And all we really did was, when we bought them, was just put our sales techniques on top of what they were already doing, and it shot right up the first couple of years, and it's still a very wonderful ongoing entity with great people that work with us now. So I do think there are those niches. But you mentioned me earlier that you buying LoyaltyWorks was a little bit like a minnow buying a whale. Tell us about that.
Well, they were.
How do you do that, by the way?
Well, they were a lot larger than we were, we were able to do it with operating income that we made with the advancements of the technology and saving money.
Right.
And a lot of that money we pass on to our clients. Our closing ratio is about 90% when we get in front of clients.
Right.
So it's been quite successful. And the people, the employees that we brought over from LoyaltyWorks were their greatest asset. And it would have taken me years to be able to duplicate that.
Many small business guys that do look at perhaps acquiring another business, but you almost always look at a smaller business. That's just intuitive, the way you do it. Now, you're not the first person that's told me they bought a larger business. I'm always intrigued by that. I've had several consultants that I would be looking at something and say, well, you should look at a bigger company. I'm always like, oh, I'm a little nervous about that, getting a bigger one. That had to be kind of nerve-wracking to do that, I would think, back when you started that.
No, it was just, frankly, it was just a clear formula.
Wow.
And they needed it. And frankly, we needed them. Our business now is very much based on search engine optimization.
Right.
And so we wait until people come to see us. And then we put together a good product at a very good price. And as I said, the closing ratio is pretty good.
Well, let's talk about that business overall. You told us a little bit about LoyaltyWorks already, but I know you and I in another discussion one time had talked about the challenge of companies that perhaps sell through distribution or reps, and the problem that you have if you're a company that you make some widget and you're trying to get distributors to sell it, the problem you have is that distributor is not just carrying your product, they're carrying other people's stuff, and it's the idea of getting their attention. And that's where you come in, right?
Absolutely. I just wrote a blog posting that was, are you irrelevant to your distribution? And everybody has a love-hate relationship with their distributors.
Right? Right.
They love them. They need them. They have salespeople. They take inventory. They allow them to get more market expansion. But they hate them because they're not getting the attention that they need. So how do you get that attention? How do you get them engaged? So companies use our marketing platform and basically our principles behind getting those salespeople's attention for pushing their product.
Basically, a salesperson in that company gets a reward for pushing my product, and you provide the vehicle to do that. Is that?
Yes, in simplest form. I mean, there's a multitude of steps, but the first step is to assess what your competition's doing.
Right.
If you are in a mature market, which most of us are,
right,
and you have a product that it can easily be reproduced and it's strictly a price situation, then how do you get the attention of that respective distributor
right.
without suffering the decline in your margins.
Right.
Well, the first thing is you try to create a better incentive program, because a lot of them do have incentive programs. It's got to be easier to understand. It's got to be more immediate. The old Pavlovian theory of the amount of reward and time it takes to get the reward are directly related. So if I can reduce the amount of time that it takes to get it, I can reduce the expense of it. So those things are all involved. You have to communicate it. And then you have to train on the features and benefits of the respective product. And then, and I think this is important, is you need to get feedback back from those respective distributors and their distributor reps as to what's going out in the marketplace. You know, how is that product fitting in? What changes need to be made? What changes are there in terms of customer service or financing or something of that nature? And these platforms now accomplish all this. It used to be extremely paper intensive.
Right.
Now it's all done online or through your smartphone.
Steve, we were distributing a product for a number of years, and what they would and we would exceed our sales goals, and every year they would send us live Maine lobsters. We didn't ask; they just came, and FedEx would deliver these live lobsters. And, you know, okay, then first year I took them home. I don't like lobster that much, but I took them home, cooked them, and then second year I gave an employee and he took them home and cooked them. Well, the third year they came, no one would take them. So here we are with these live lobsters. It can't get rid of, but that may also be a downside to incentives, isn't it?
Well, once again, that competition should have created a better incentive program for you in order to get your attention.
I was just pointing out probably the way not to do an incentive program.
Absolutely.
It's probably the way to do that. You know, I do think that the idea of, you know, and I am more obvious. I'm more on the distributor side. We sell products and service products that other people manufacture for the most part. But I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I do have the same, the people that sell their products through us have the same problems you're describing, because, you know, we obviously want the products. That's how we make money. But you do, when you go somewhere, when you're going in to see a client, you are there to do something, and probably whatever you're incentivized to do at that moment the best, and a lot of that's what you're going to do.
Well, I think in a perfect world, you're going to do what's best for your client.
Well, sure, yeah.
But all things being equal, you're also going to do what's best for you too.
Right.
And so if it means that it's easier to sell, that you understand it better, or that you get some kind of compensation for it, then you'll sell that.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Driven to Business. Stick around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. By the way, keep in mind, we're streaming live, if you're getting out of car range, here on biz1190.com. The program today will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. So go there and check us out. We're talking with Steve Damereau, the Chief Executive Officer of Loyalty Works. Steve, let's say I'm a company and I feel like I need, or maybe I don't even know I need, but I need some incentives, whether I know it or not, to get my distributors to pay better attention to me. What do you do for us?
Well, first of all, we partner. We don't sell.
Right.
And these systems, the legacy systems, some of my competitors, and I do have competitors out there, they have a system that takes somewhere between $50,000 to $100,000 in fixed expense and takes 6 months to set up.
Right.
With our technology, ours takes about $5,000. You can have a program up for $5,000, and it takes about 6 weeks to get up.
Right.
So we don't make our money on the actual platform. We make our money when the programs are successful, and it's all strictly a variable expense. So it's a no-brainer for a client, but we first have to recognize within that client that there's a potential for us, because we're the ones that are investing our time and money into it.
Right.
So the first thing you once again that you have to do is you have to assess what your competition is, and then you have to assess what are the key performance indicators, namely how will you define what is a success. And I know that sounds like all much of marketing jumbo, but it's really basic common sense.
All right? Yes, it is.
What are your objectives? What are we going to do to reach those objectives? When we reach those objectives, what's our next step? What are our return on investment analytics? So basically, these programs are designed for increasing what we call points of engagement with those distributors, and it's all done via the web or traditional print pieces, or it's all done via mobile phones now. And it's getting in front of those distributors and those distributor reps so that they'll push your product over somebody else's.
You know, Steve, you'd started your company, and one of the things you had said was you use superior technology even to make the companies you purchased successful with that. So let's talk about marketing and technology in this modern era. You know, you'd mentioned the web, mobile phones, even targeted television now. And you know, nowadays we're approaching an era now where I'm assuming you're aware of this, where the commercial I'm watching on my television set during a program may not be the commercial you're watching on your television set. I mean, we target programming. You have radio, like here at Biz 1190. And there are so many marketing vehicles available to a company today, which is really good in one sense. But in the other sense, it also presents a problem, doesn't it, having that much available to us?
Well, one of the things that we have is what's called an umbrella program. And that means that if you talk to marketers, they say, oh, we have so many of these disparate programs everywhere and we're having a hard time managing it. Well, now on my platform, they can manage all these programs. So
right. They
could manage their travel incentive program for their distributor principals. They could manage their sales programs for the dealer salespeople. It can be in 50 different countries and 30 different languages. It can be specific to a respective distributor. It can have a different payout, a different rule structure, different artwork. It can be managed by surveys and so forth. And then once again, it'll all go through either a PC or a mobile phone. A lot of the clients will start off and they'll say, well, you know, my people aren't that sophisticated, or they're really not that tech savvy. Well, this doesn't require sophistication or
right.
tech savvy. It's,
right.
it's simple. You know, and when they can get a big screen TV for their efforts, they will go online and they will take your survey and they will order that TV.
In fact, I think for most of us, if we're depending on our customers or clients to be tech savvy, we may be hurting there. That's not a lot of them, even though they may use technology profusely, they're not that savvy about it. They're going to take the simplest. You know, the example I use for people sometimes is like on a website, our websites that we manage. We try to make the navigation very simple. People are just not going to sit there and mess around trying to figure out where something is on your website. They've got to find it.
It's the old KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid.
Exactly. And I'm often called that, by the way. So the reason I take no offense. Hey, you know, when our company started, a little different business, but when we started, we've moved away from this a bit, but when we started, I was doing in-house repairs, mainly a lot of circuit board repairs for manufacturers of industrial equipment. And I learned that although these decisions were very important to me, who the industrial plant sent that repair to, it wasn't that important to the plant as long as they felt like they were getting a reliable repair. But then I did reliable repairs, but so did a lot of other people. And at first I was trying to sell the fact I do reliable repairs, and I figured out that so is everybody else. So that's not an advantage. And it really came down to us a lot of times. We learned, sometimes to our chagrin, that the people that got the business were the last people in the door. And the last guy in there whose business card happened to be sitting on that guy's desk when he needed that service is who he's going to call. So our marketing push became be the last guy in somehow. If it's not through actually being there, then you know, give him, instead of leaving a business card, give him some metal sticker to stick on his desk or something. And then, you know, really in some ways, even though we've come in the web era, it's still that to an extent, isn't it? I mean, in many ways, that's what you guys at LoyaltyWorks are trying to do, is really just raise the profile, pull out of the crowd a bit for your clients in front of their customers.
I think you just got my sales pitch.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, no, it's all points of engagement, and it's keeping it simple. And you know, whether the reward is a prepaid Visa card or a store gift card, or you're choosing from a rewards mall that is very similar to a combination of Amazon and Expedia and HubSpot. It's all a question of getting in front of these people, being in front of them, and making it easy for them, and to actually give them a feeling that they're part of your team,
right?
Because they succeed when you succeed.
Exactly. By the way, for those of you listening, the program today will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. And if you'll click on that podcast, within there will be links to Steve and his company and ways to get in touch with him. So go there and check that out. Steve, I always tell our folks, that things change. I've said sort of jokingly before that if I were investing in a company that started with the business plan I started with today, I wouldn't invest a nickel because the business we started in doesn't really exist anymore. It's just, you know, circuit boards are mostly throwaways now. They didn't used to be in our business. And an analogy I use sometimes is you used to have people come to your office and fix and actually repair your computer. Well, most people don't do that anymore. They, you know, if a computer breaks, they just get another computer. And in many ways, in the industrial business we're in, that's what it's like now too, because of the cost of technology driving things down. But even though we live in an era of rapid change, many companies seem to ignore these changes, and that's to their peril, I would think. Don't you?
I see that there's a much more open mind to it, but there are still companies out there. You know, the old saying, and I date myself here, that nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. You remember that?
Exactly. Yes.
And well, why was that? Well, okay, IBM was expensive, but it worked. In our particular case, we compete against companies that are 100 years old, and they have a good reputation and they do a fine job, but they have legacy systems. And it's 10 times more expensive as ours and takes 10 times as long to do it, but some people will still continue to buy from them because nobody ever got fired for buying IBM.
That's a good point. And it's a bit hard to overcome objections. Sometimes you have to work to overcome. I can recall calling on a client many years ago who was using a General Electric for some of their large equipment. And I was trying to get them to let us service that because we were less expensive. I always thought we were better, still do. And we were certainly more fun to deal with than the large bureaucracy you had to deal with at GE. But one of the guys there in a paper mill, the guy told me, he said, you know, here's the bottom line. I said, I like you. But he said, if I call GE out here and they screw up, it's GE's fault. He said, but if I call you out here and you screw up, it's going to be my fault.
That's sad but true.
And so you do have to fight that, don't you?
You do have to fight it. Our business model is that we have very sophisticated technology, but we try to keep it simple. And our entire business model is based upon people taking a 45-minute web demo. So very simply, they take the 45-minute web demo either through WebEx or GoToMeeting. At which point they recognize that what the system does, they look at examples, other clients, and then they either want it or they don't. The net effect is my sales costs are very, very low, and I pass those savings on to them.
All right. We only have about a minute left, so we may have to talk this after the break. But, you know, even guys like us that have sort of tried to stay on top of this technology wave, here to speak, I find myself still sometimes surprised at things going. I'll give you, for instance, I track very carefully who comes to our website, and I haven't paid much attention in the past as to what kind of operating system, because I didn't really care if it was a Mac or Windows or Linux, or it made a difference to me. But nowadays, so many people coming to our site are coming to there on their phones. Mm-hmm. Well, that does make a difference because people act differently on a website with their phone. And I know that you guys at LoyaltyWorks deal with that all the time and are looking toward the future on that. And perhaps after the break, you can talk to us about what you're up to in that area, perhaps, with technology you see coming.
Certainly.
And changing. We still got about a minute, by the way. Our producer just told me, so I could jump the gun a bit there. So give us about a minute blurb on that.
Well, I'll give you an example of the immediacy. So say, for instance, you have a salesperson. And he wants to claim that he actually changed his behavior and he sold something or whatever, and he wants to get the benefit from it. Well, our system will allow him to basically put in that claim into his smartphone.
Right.
That information comes to us. It might go into a pending file. It might be subject to validation. But then he gets an immediate response back stating, thank you for you changing your behavior, and you'll be getting your reward soon.
So there is a feedback, and he's basically has told you that what he's done, so you know up front that this thing has changed with him. That is fascinating, and I'm not in the phone business, but I am sort of amazed at what has happened, and I think maybe the time that our kids grow up, I don't know that they'll have laptops. I don't know. There's no telling what they're going to be doing.
There's no telling.
Or typing or anything else. I mean, there's just not a bit of telling. We have some friends. I have a good friend that's invested in a large. I say invested. He's a consultant to a large telecommunication company, and what he tells me is coming, you know, is when you walk into a place of business, your smartphone will register to that business you're there, or register to some database that you're in there, and then not only you're in there, but what part of the store you're in. Then when you go home at night and you're in your house, you're going to see ads on television that, that will be targeted to the places that you either have been online visiting or have physically visited. Or the, so, you know, on the one way, it's really fascinating. The other side is a little bit scary for some of us, I think.
That's very Orwellian.
That we are facing that kind of thing. You're listening to Driven to Business. We're here every Saturday morning, and I'm glad you're here. My name is Eddie Mayfield. A little more to come, but not a lot, so don't go anywhere. Welcome to the final segment of this week's Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield, and I'm glad you're here. And I'm also glad that Steve Damereaux is here. We've been having an interesting discussion. Steve, we've been talking about your company off and on for a while and how you founded a company and you bought another company and you've been very successful in it. Let's just talk for a moment about your management style, your leadership style, I mean, and perhaps any advice you might have to those listening.
Well,
I know that's a hard question to throw at somebody.
It is a hard question, and I think everybody's a little bit different. But in my particular case, I believe that my best assets walk out the door at 5 o'clock.
Right.
There are all sorts of statistics and studies out that talks about how much it costs to retrain somebody. I compensate people on what it would take to replace them. And I think when you sit down and you look at it and you look at the package, what would it take to replace them? Not what you're paying them, all right, but what would it cost you to replace them?
That's a smart way to look at that.
And so the net effect is that I like to say that we eat our own cooking. So all of my employees are on incentive programs.
Right.
And they're both cash incentive programs and they are points programs. And one of the issues that I had when I took over LoyaltyWorks is you got two different cultures.
Right.
Well, what we do is within our system, we have these plug-and-play modules. So we have a plug-and-play module for a distributor program, for a contractor program, for an HR program, for a safety program, for a wellness program, and people can plug and play these modules.
Right.
Well, we try all these modules out on our employees first.
Ah.
All right. And so, namely, from an HR standpoint, we created a module where it's kind of a social media situation, and people get points for finding things that people do right and recognizing them online. We were voted best and brightest place to work in Atlanta, top 50 marketing agencies in Atlanta, and it's because of what we do for these employees. Now, having said that, they do a lot for us, but I match 401k. And I pay 100% of their health insurance, and they get basically $100 worth of points for every year that they've been employed. And I have some that have been there for 18 years, so they're getting $1,800 worth of points every holiday season, which is and then they use it to go shopping on our online rewards mall, which by the way, I use for my own kids. It's a great way to get out of Christmas shopping. So we try to treat their employees like they are our greatest asset.
You know, I've noticed, and there are other great examples of that, even right here in Atlanta, that companies like Chick-fil-A and people who their employees are their biggest fans. And, you know, a happy and an employer that's part of a positive culture that tends to reflect to customers. And I think anybody in business, you know, I heard a speech by Ross Perot many years ago. If you want your employees to be friendly to people, why don't you first place hire friendly employees and then be friendly to them? I mean, see if that doesn't work as far as the friend. And I do. I admire the what you've had to say about that.
I voted for Ross Perot.
This when I heard his speech was long before Ross ever got into politics. Back just he was just a yeah. You know, he was a people forget what an incredible entrepreneur that guy was back.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Speaking of entrepreneurs and leadership and business in general, Steve, from your vantage point, are you concerned about the general direction of our country and where we're going?
Well, I think everybody is. I think if you are a small business owner, you have to be. I mean, the reason that I decided to come to the United States, to stay in the United States, was because of the lack of bureaucracy. you know, I don't want anything from the government. I just want them to leave me alone. But I have to compete. And to give you an example, we spend millions of dollars on R&D. And the Canadian government gives competitors of mine a tax credit for that.
Right.
So they literally get this R&D for nothing.
Right.
Whereas I have to pay for it.
Right.
So yeah, I'm a bit concerned. But you know, it runs in cycles. I mean, we went through Jimmy Carter, and then it ran in a cycle, and hopefully the cycle will come back.
You do hope so. I tried not to be too cynical and not to be too pessimistic about things, because I particularly think as a leader of a company, you really cannot be pessimistic. That's going to reflect down through your organization. It's not what you want to do, but I'm ready for the cycle to swing a bit back toward where people that are successful are admired and not somehow the villains for everyone's problems, and that's such a short-sighted view. I've mentioned on the program several times, probably too often. I was in Russia not too long ago, and after getting back, we interviewed here on Driven to Business a gentleman who's Dan Whitten, who's an international tax advisor and actually had done some consulting with the Russians after the fall of communism as to how to make their society more entrepreneurial, at least from a tax policy standpoint. And I was telling him that when I was in Moscow and St. Petersburg, I had no idea what to expect there, but there's a very entrepreneurial class growing out of there right now. And it's almost like they're running away from what we're running toward, and that does bother me a bit.
Well, you bring up a great point. I recently read a study where they asked the poll. It was 1,000 people in this poll, and you don't know what time they took the poll or anything of that nature, but they asked the people, they say, who said from those who have the ability to those that have the need? And 30% of them said George Washington. 15% of them said Barack Obama. Of course, it was Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto.
Right.
I think that if you asked the average teenager in the United States what problem that they have with that sentence, they would say none. And on paper, it does look good. But the fact of the matter is that the reason the United States, case in point, the reason that we are becoming energy independent, and you and I discussed this at lunch the other day,
right,
is because of an initiative. It's because of the initiative that we established the fracking and the horizontal drilling, and it was done by some men who risked their money and should get the payback. You know, one of the things that you bring up, I'm giving you an example. As a small business owner, if you have a C-Corp, okay,
right,
and you make $200,000 in profit, you're going to spend 39% taxes
exactly
on that $200,000.
Right.
Okay, then you want to take that profit out, okay, and if you're at the highest tax bracket, you're going to pay another 45% on top of that for the taxes.
I have often, and I ask this question of a couple of tax guys, do you think how many congressmen actually know, for instance, what a sub-S corporation is, where your income, and the answer has always been no, we don't think many congressmen even know what that is.
Well, I don't think that they were community organizers, but I don't think most of them have had jobs before.
That's probably a whole other topic, isn't it?
I think it might be.
In about a minute here, just for our edification, what have you found to be the most effective way of marketing your services? Is it the web, or is it direct mail or print or what?
Well, because ours is somewhat of a complex product,
right,
for a very simple solution, we invest a lot of money in search engine optimization.
Right.
And basically, the principle is basically this. Somebody needs something. They recognize that they have a need. They Google it. And hopefully we show up, they look at our website, and they say, okay, these guys appear to have what it is that we need. And by the way, our clients are anything from Fortune 100 to companies that are under $20 million. Okay. I mean, most of the recipients of these rewards or participants are contractors or distributor salespeople or truck drivers, or they could be high-tech value-added. So it very much depends.
Well, I think the entire idea that this goes along with what we, even in the more general sense, what we've been talking about, the idea that the incentives of capitalism do work, and even on a micro scale, is perhaps incentivizing your employees or your distributors or whomever to that there's a reward, and it's a very it's a clear reward of hard work. And when you're successful at it, is that you make some money for it. And at the very moment that incentive is taken away, all kinds of things. You know, this back to as we end the program here. You know, it's not that these great experiments at Marx and he's got. We know what happened. We have history, and we know what happened in those things. And great guest, Steve. Thanks for coming on.
It's been my pleasure.
Driven to Business.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We'll be back next week. We'll see you then. Bye bye.
Listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.